see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
When you think of Louis Armstrong, this might be among one of the first songs that comes to mind. Armstrong's popularity peaked in the 1960s with this and a number of other songs like Hello Dolly, which pushed the Beatles out of their long-standing number one spot on the music charts. But our guest this hour says Armstrong's influence on music and society began well before that, in the 1920s and 30s. And he explains why Armstrong was, as he calls it, a master of modernism. Hello, I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Are you a fan of Louis Armstrong? Do you appreciate his contributions to American music? And how has his work touched you? We hope you'll join the conversation this hour at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. Thomas Brothers joins us. He's a professor of music at Duke University and the author of three books about Louis Armstrong. Most recently, Louis Armstrong, Master of Modernism. Thomas, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Cynthia. It's great to be here.
Happy to have you. Well, this is your third book about Louis Armstrong. What do you find so compelling about him as a subject?
Yes, I told somebody that the other day, and she said, gosh, that's a little obsessive. But, you know, it has never felt like that to me because, first of all, the music is so great, so I never get tired of the music, and I never get tired of studying it and learning about it and hearing music that's related to it and so forth. And second, the history is so great. The context in which all this happened is just very rich and compelling. So for me, it's a great combination, the history, the social context, and the musical achievement.
And this book in particular focuses on the work he did in the 1920s and 30s when his career first took off, and specifically when he made the transition from New Orleans to Chicago. Why did you pick up at that point?
Well, if I can just backtrack a little bit, my first book is an edition of his writings, and I did that in the late 1990s, called Louis Armstrong in His Own Words. And that was an edition of 19 documents that he had written. And so I gathered these together. He loved to write. He took a typewriter with him around when he toured and wrote backstage. He called it his hobby. Writing was his hobby. And when I was trying to contextualize what he was saying, he's a terrific witness. I mean, he gives a lot of details about what happened and so forth. And so I was trying to contextualize what he was saying, and that's how I got into doing more historical work on him. And then the next book I wrote was called Louis Armstrong's New Orleans, which is about the first 21 years of his life growing up in New Orleans. And that was just a wonderful book. I'm a huge fan of New Orleans now, and I go there as often as I can. And it was a great time. So that's the period of when jazz was really formed. I mean, he grew up when jazz was born, basically. And then so that finished at 1922, and when he left New Orleans. And so this book picks up there, and when he arrives in Chicago, as part of the Great Migration, really, of African Americans from the South, from the rural South and the urban South, into cities in the North. And it follows him for the next 10 years up through 1932.
And take us along on his journey. What was his objective as he went to Chicago, and who did he meet?
Well, you know, it took him, he was one of the last to leave, actually, because he was doing very well in New Orleans, actually. He was starting to establish himself as a pretty successful musician. He liked New Orleans. He's sort of a homebody at that point. A number of his older colleagues had already left the city, including Joe Oliver, who was sort of his mentor in his mid-teens. And Oliver and these others had settled in Chicago, especially. That was a destination point for a lot of African Americans from New Orleans and from Louisiana generally. It's a sort of straight shot up to Chicago on the train lines. And so when he went to New Orleans, it was at Oliver's request, actually. Or when he went to Chicago, it was at Oliver's request. And he stepped into a band that was very, very familiar to him. They were playing the kind of music that he knew from New Orleans, the kind of music he was really good at. And so it was a very easy transition in that sense. You know, this is part of the Great Migration, though. So, that's a very important phenomenon for him. And that really picked up in the mid-teens, and that is the story of some 50,000 African-Americans moving into the south side of Chicago. And they are the primary audience for Louis Armstrong during his years in Chicago. And they're the ones who are the patronage base that is really supporting his musical achievement. So that's really an important little social connection to understand and think about.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about that context you were referring to earlier. Draw a picture of the greater context surrounding Louis Armstrong back in the 1920s and 30s.
Well, when he gets to Chicago, he steps into Oliver's band, and Oliver has been crowned king of Lincoln Gardens, which is a big dance hall on the South Side, an exclusively black dance hall. And so Oliver's solo playing is really, really tremendous and really going over well and so forth. And so Armstrong's natural inclination when he gets there is to try to imitate Oliver. And Oliver was playing a certain kind of music that the New Orleanians called freak music, which meant you use some kind of object, manipulate it over the bell of the horn, the trumpet, and to get talking-like effects. So, for example, a toilet plunger or a bottle or a hat or just your hand. This there was a slight gimmicky dimension to this.
Mm-hmm.
But the music was very powerful and very bluesy. And this is a deeply rooted African-American tradition that certainly goes back to Africa and was extremely well-received. So Armstrong tried to play this music at Lincoln Gardens, and he wasn't that good at it. He was nervous, and he couldn't coordinate his hands and so forth. So eventually, his fiancée, Lillian Hardin, convinced him to go in his own direction and find his own way, and that's exactly what he did. And what he came out with was something that really transformed the whole musical scene in Chicago.
How so?
there are a couple steps along the way here. The first thing is that Lillian tries to encourages him to break away from Oliver, because Oliver is managing his money, for one thing. There's a very paternal relationship going on here. And Oliver, in Lillian's view, is holding him back because he realizes Armstrong's potential and he doesn't want him to overshadow him. So Lillian encourages him to break away, and he ultimately, in 1924, goes to New York City and accepts an offer to play with Fletcher Henderson's orchestra. Now, this is a very different kind of music that he's going to step into here. This is at a Midtown Manhattan ballroom, whites only. So it's a huge shift, and Fletcher Henderson's dance band is basically the best-paid African-American dance orchestra in the country, probably, at this point, and playing for whites only. So they're playing popular tunes of the day and arrangements that are on notated arrangements and so forth, and Armstrong is brought into this band to be the hot soloist, to play a kind of music that is sounds like it's improvised and has a lot of markers of African-American musical expression, has bluesy effects, has a lot of rhythmic drive, and is very exciting. And this is this sort of sprinkled into the arrangement for contrast with the rest of the popular song that dominates the arrangement. So that's what Armstrong finds himself in 1924 and 25. And it's a perfect opportunity for him because he has a chance to really experiment with what a hot solo is going to be like. So he does that over this year with Henderson, and he's very successful. Then the next step for him is in the fall of 1925, December actually, he goes back to Chicago. Lillian finally convinces him to return, and he steps into a place called the Vendome Theater. And this is the place where he says, about a few years later, he says, that's the place where I develop my style. So that is to me, one of the most important venues in his career, the Vendome Theater. Now, this is a place that's, and of all the places where jazz was performed in the 20s, this is the one that is most unlike what we think of. And this is a movie theater, basically. But these are silent pictures, of course. So you have an orchestra, and they're accompanying the silent picture. And Armstrong's job is like everybody else's job in the orchestra to play the score that accompanies the picture. But by this time, they had also developed a tradition of the orchestra playing a little concert in between showings of the movie. And this orchestra at the Vendome Theater was probably the best African-American orchestra in the country. Very sophisticated music that they're playing. They're playing light opera overtures, William Tell overture, Poet and the Peasant, things like this. This is a huge step up for him. This is where he converts from the cornet, which is his instrument in New Orleans, and it's a shorter version of a trumpet. It's a marching band instrument primarily. And he converts to the trumpet, which is an orchestral instrument. And his part of his job here is also to play hot solos, because the Vendome Theater is interested in branching out and having different kinds of music for different audiences to expand their patronage base. And so they bring him in to play hot solos. And that's where he says he developed his style.
We're talking with Thomas Brothers. He's a professor of music at Duke University and the author of Louis Armstrong, Master of Modernism. You're welcome to join our conversation about Louis Armstrong and his influence on American music at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. You can even tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the life and music of Louis Armstrong with Thomas Brothers. He's a professor of music at Duke University and the author of Louis Armstrong, Master of Modernism. You're welcome to join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@WPR.org. You can also comment on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Thomas Brothers, I wanted to ask you, why did you choose to call Louis Armstrong a master of modernism?
Well, the first reason is that his agent used that as a phrase for marketing him in 1930. They called him Louis Armstrong, Master of Modernism and Creator of a Song Style. So the 1920s was a period that really liked to think of itself as very modern, and modern was always a good thing. I mean, if you were called modern, then that was great. That's what you wanted to be. And there was lots of, and the word modernism was used quite frequently in different contexts. So I don't think anybody really was surprised by this label that this agent gave him. And I don't think anybody doubted it, that Armstrong was a master of modernism. So what I'm arguing is actually in this book that Armstrong created two modern styles during this period that I cover. The first is in the mid and late 20s, and that's the music we know as the Hot Five. Excuse me. And the second is in the early 30s, and that's the music that is primarily a vocal style, actually, and that's where he's singing popular tunes. Both of these kinds of music were very radical at their time. They were very challenging to listen to, actually. They were exciting. There was something very fresh and new, something very sophisticated that was obviously sophisticated and could not be done by a lot of people. And so modern is a good word, I think, for it.
Mm-hmm. You know, before we dig into that a little bit further, I want to work in a caller here. We have Barb in Green Bay on the line. Hi, Barb.
Hi. I turned the radio on, and I just about fell over because I have been smitten with Louis Armstrong since probably third grade. I just have a anecdote that I met him when I was in third grade at a fair. Both my grandparents lived in Dubuque, Iowa, so it was somewhere in that vicinity, and I don't know if it was a county fair or a state fair, but my grandpa took me to see him, and I was already just enamored with him, and it was during that Hello Dolly era, but I went back to his trailer before he would come on stage, and he came out with that grin of his and his band, and he gave me 5 autographs, of which I have none today, and the drummer gave me his drumsticks. And I think at that time, for my age, his voice was just to find someone that sang like that and then talked like that. That just that was his voice, period. And that just blew me away. And, you know, that gravelly earthiness. And I have been smitten with him, you know, since. And what a humanitarian, and all these things I've come to learn about him and will explore in your books, because I have always loved jazz music. And Dad and I went down to the Louis Armstrong Park in New Orleans, fortunately, before Katrina came. And I just feel him. That's it, plain and simple.
Yeah, well, that's great, Barb. You know, I have to tell you, I was born in Wausau, Wisconsin, actually.
Oh.
And and my mother saw Louis Armstrong in Wisconsin before. It would have been in the early 50s, actually. And she remembers it. She has vivid memories of it, just like you do. He had this magnetic quality that came across the stage and came across through screen. I mean, a TV screen or a movie screen. And a lot of people have that experience that you're describing of very, very strong memory.
And Teresa on Facebook says, he's a womanizer in all senses, but damn, he could play. He is the one who invented scatting, because he dropped his trumpet and something happened where it couldn't play, so he started to sing his trumpet part. Is that how scatting was born?
Yeah, that's a good story, Teresa. I have a good bit on that in my book. I have a long section on that moment that you're describing. Heebie-jeebies in 1925, a recording from 1925. Now, it is true that marketing agents, again, presented him as the person who had invented scat. He actually didn't invent it. And he talked about, you know, hearing it when he was growing up as a child in New Orleans. And there had been earlier recordings of it, too. But his was the most famous. So his was the one that people first heard, a lot of people first heard, especially white people, I would say. That was their first exposure to scat. And so people tended to associate it with him. And he used it so stylized and so beautifully, actually, that was a natural kind of association.
Well, let's circle back to the two modern art forms that you were talking about that he invented. I can't remember if I interrupted you before you got to your second one.
Well, that's the song style from the early 30s, the popular ballads and so forth. Yeah.
Ragging the tune, as it's called?
Yes, exactly. That would have been the tradition that he knew in New Orleans. It's called ragging the tune, which is where our sense of ragtime. Scott Joplin talked about ragtime, called his music ragtime, and that comes from a tradition of ragging the tune on piano. Mm. So it was a very widespread practice in the 19th century of taking an established tune, African-American musicians, and giving their own version of it, heavily ornamented, heavily reconceived. There was no sense that you had to limit yourself to the tune itself. As somebody talks about Armstrong, he fractures ballads. He picks them apart and puts them back together. And that is a lot of what he's doing. It's so interesting and so creative, the way he's transforming these popular songs. So for a lot of them, take an example like Sweethearts on Parade, which was recorded by the Lombardo Band. We don't care about the tune today. What we care about is Armstrong's version of it. Hello, Dolly is a great example of that, too. The composers of Hello, Dolly must have a toast to Louis Armstrong every summer on his birthday, because without him, I don't know how many people know their song, Hello, Dolly. So he has this gift of melodic transformation. And that's a lot of what is going on in the early 30s.
I think in your book you used an example of Lazy River from 1931. Am I right in remembering that was an example of ragging the tune?
Yes.
Or was that?
Yeah.
Okay. I have a clip of that. We can take a listen to it. Do you want to set it up and explain what's going to happen?
Why don't you play it a little and then we'll talk about it.
Okay.
Up Lazy River where old mill run. Meet the lazy river with the noonday sun. Linger in the shade of a kind old tree. Throw away your trouble, dream a dream of me, dream a dream of me. Up the lazy river where the robin's song wakes to bright new morning as we loaf along. Blue skies up above, everyone in love. Up the lazy river, how happy we will be, mama, mama. Oh, up the lazy river, up the lazy river. Boy, if I rip this evening, I hope something.
So two different verses of that song, and they sound different.
Yeah, so what he's saying there is, oh, boy, I'm riffing tonight. Oh, you dog, you. So he's talking to himself during the performance, these little asides. He's always keeping you on your toes. You're never quite sure what his relationship to the song is. In this case, he's obviously using it. The first statement, as you said, is kind of relaxed, and you can feel like you're drifting down the river, and his phrasing is very free from the beat. He has simplified the melody a lot. He's not taking the melody as it was written and just giving you that version. He's simplified it tremendously, emphasizing his phrasing details and his bluesy touches. And then he goes into what he calls riffing, which was the word that they used for scat in New Orleans. So when he says, I'm riffing tonight, he's referring to his scat invention. And basically he's using his voice as an instrument there. And again, having a totally new creation of the melody that's in no relationship. Actually, I should say it's no relationship to the original melody. He's using the words, but he's totally free invention, just as the way he would freely invent a trumpet solo. So he's showing off a little bit.
1-800-642-1234 is the number to call if you have any questions about the life and career of Louis Armstrong, or you'd like to share why you appreciate his music and his contribution to music. We have Lyle and Winona on the line.
Oh, hi. I teach a course on early jazz, birth of jazz, and I'm just fascinated by this. Where is this stash of notes located? Where did you get your hands on this stuff?
My documentary evidence?
Right.
Yeah, okay. Well, there's a lot of documentary evidence that I'm using in these books, and it gets a little out of hand. When I submitted this book and all its reference notes to the publisher, they were a little alarmed. But there are a number of sources. One is the first one, and the way I really got into this was first-person accounts. So Louis Armstrong's memoirs, his autobiographies, and oral histories, a lot of them done with musicians. And those are located at the Hogan Jazz Archive in New Orleans, at the Williams Research Center in New Orleans, at the Institute of Jazz Studies in Newark, New Jersey. There's a bunch of places. In Chicago, there's some places. And secondly, actually, one thing that was new for this book was now I can do a lot of keyword searching on historically black newspapers. So the Chicago Defender, for example, the Pittsburgh Courier, the New York Amsterdam News, there's about 7 or 8 of them. And I can just keyword search from my desk and on the web, and it's an incredible resource. So that really opened up a lot, too. Those are the kind of things I'm using.
Well, anyway, great job. I have a couple of comments. One is clarifying the difference between a trumpet and a cornet.
Yes.
The cornet is actually a conical instrument and has a very mellow sound. It's more like a baritone or a tenor horn.
Okay, right.
Flugelhorn-like. Actually, today's cornet is not like the old cornet.
Uh-huh.
Old cornet, there's a real difference. It's a very mellow, very sweet sound.
Right.
Okay.
By contrast, is a cylindrical instrument, and it has a very piercing sound.
Uh-huh.
So it will dominate. And so and it's also a larger instrument.
Thanks, Lyle. Did you have anything else to add to that about the cornet?
Yes,
Thomas?
It was a big transition for him. You're right. It was not just a simple thing of a longer instrument. I kind of simplified it there, but you're absolutely right. So he actually had a stage skit with it. He did where about giving up his little old cornet for a trumpet and kind of making fun of it.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you say that Armstrong's style, which at times sounds improvisational and off the cuff, as we just heard, was as innovative and deliberate as Beethoven, Stravinsky, or even the Beatles in his music. What makes you say that?
Well, So this is a little complicated, and it's not that there was just one thing going on. There were different ways of doing this. But Armstrong makes it quite clear that a lot of things that he played, a lot of the great solos that we love, were not improvised. They were melodies that he had worked up over time and played the same way every night. And it's not surprising that he would do this. When you think about vaudeville, which is his music is being heard in a lot of vaudeville contexts. You think about a tap dancer or something like that, or a comedian. I mean, they're not improvising in the 20s. There's no expectation that they're improvising. People thought of his music as improvised because it's from the African-American vernacular, and it's not notated. So there's a big difference. It can be not notated, but it can still be crafted over time and fixed. And so a lot of his solos were like this. They were carefully designed. They weren't just spontaneous outpourings. Now, on the other hand, there were some recordings where he definitely, they needed an extra recording that day, so they pulled out something and he improvised a solo. Or they took two takes of recording, and on the second one he improvised. That definitely does happen. But it's not correct to expect that all this was improvised music.
I was surprised to learn that he admired Guy Lombardo, because Guy Lombardo strikes me as one of the most straight-laced big band leaders that there ever was. What appealed to Louis Armstrong about Guy Lombardo?
Well, that's a good question. There's several layers to this story, actually, and it's in 1928, I believe, where he actually met Guy Lombardo, and Guy Lombardo invited him to a performance he was giving, which was a whites-only performance in Chicago. And Armstrong was greeted at the door and escorted to a table with a spotlight, and the band announced his arrival from the stage. This is a dramatic moment, actually. This is not something that was familiar to Armstrong in his experience. And the admiration, so in other words, Lombardo really admired Armstrong, and as did a lot of white musicians in Chicago at this time. They would often go to hear him at the black and tan clubs on the South Side, the Sunset Cafe and so forth, and they would just sit there soaking this up. That's how he became really the most important soloist in jazz, is the white musicians' attention to him. They memorized his solos. They built their own styles on what he was doing. That's an extremely important dimension of the period. And Lombardo is just like the others. In terms of his admiration for Lombardo, this is challenging. Lombardo's playing what was called sweet jazz, or sweet style, in the period, which meant that there wasn't really a lot of syncopation, wasn't a lot of rhythmic excitement, wasn't any bluesy touches and so forth. Very close to the popular tune and so forth. Armstrong admired great musicianship, for one thing, as did all jazz musicians still admire great musicianship, no matter who it is, really. There's a great regard for what you can do on your horn and excellence on the horn. Secondly, we would have to note that he admired Lombardo's popularity. So Armstrong was popular on the South Side of Chicago, but he could never attain the kind of success at that time that Lombardo was achieving. And Lombardo, and that, of course, has to do with audience base, with white audiences. Armstrong is still playing for black audiences in 1927, 1928. And so in order to get out of that, to expand his audience base and reach white audiences, how is he going to do that? Well, he's going to look to successful musicians like Lombardo and see what they're doing. And he does that, actually, in the next few years, and he reaches huge white audiences.
How did those audiences initially respond to his style, though?
I think they thought it was exotic. They thought it was primitive. They assumed it was improvised. They assumed it was spontaneous and uncalculated. A lot of the stereotypes of African-American creativity are in play during this period. And a lot of them definitely were projected on Armstrong. but he convinces them, actually. And he does that in pieces like The Lazy River that we saw, just because he's so great, actually, just because he's so excellent in the way he crafts melodies. It's just very persuasive in the way he converts melodies, the way he transforms them.
There's a certain irony, though, and I'm wondering if it was lost on the crowds of the time or not, that he, as an African-American, couldn't do many of the things that his audience could do. He couldn't be in the same places that his audience could be. Can you comment on that a bit?
Yes. Well, yes, we are totally talking about a highly structured racist environment in the 1920s and the 1930s, where there is a lot of segregation de facto or de jure, and this is absolutely a huge part of his experience. You know, his approach to racial problems is to ignore them as much as possible and just to get along with his business, I think, mainly. He definitely has that kind of attitude.
We're talking with Thomas Brothers. He's a professor of music at Duke University and the author of Louis Armstrong, Master of Modernism. You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the life and career of Louis Armstrong with Thomas Brothers. He's a professor of music at Duke University and the author of Louis Armstrong, Master of Modernism. Let's take a call from Ron in Madison. Hi, Ron.
Hi. I went to school in Boise, Idaho. And, I was in high school in the 60s. Boise's high school had a full stage, Broadway equipped, and Louis Armstrong played there. I was on the stage crew, and I ran the center spotlight on him for that show. And afterwards, the stage crew went downstairs into the dressing room area. One of us was allowed to go back to get autographs for all of us, and he reported something I've never forgotten. He said Armstrong didn't have lips. He had calluses, yeah, which told me that he was a guy who took his playing seriously. He had to spend a lot of time with that trumpet, which is why he was so good.
Thanks, Ron. What about that? He didn't have lips, he had calluses.
Yeah, there's no better. Raw meat, as he used to say. my lips are a little raw today. He used to do a stunt in the 1920s. This started at the Vendome Theater, the theater I was talking about a few minutes ago. And he would play... He was expanding the range of his instrument, actually, playing high C's, which is not an easy thing to do on the trumpet. And he would play them 350 times in a row. And the musicians would count them out on stage, and people would line up. And he said they would line up around the block waiting to get in to see if I was going to miss one.
I used to play trumpet. My lips hurt thinking about doing that. Oh.
Yeah. Worked hard, absolutely.
Let's talk to Karen in Rolling Stone, Minnesota.
Hi, what a wonderful program for close to Valentine's Day. Celebrate a man who did so much good. About 20 years ago, the 10th of February, my husband donated bone marrow to a little 5-year-old boy who had leukemia. That little boy survived, so we are celebrating 20 years of his life. And about 2 years after that, Milwaukee Children's Hospital had an event for children who had received bone marrow and who were survivors. And Mia Hamm, who was a very famous soccer player whose brother had had leukemia, brought her soccer team to Milwaukee. They played a demonstration game. And after the game, the bone marrow donors, their families, and the children and their families were all at the game. And after the game, all of the children and their donors came down onto the field and walked around the field to celebrate while Louis Armstrong's voice sang What a Wonderful World. It was one of the most touching events, I think, of my life to be there and watch that. There was not one single dry eye there, and what a perfect way to celebrate the wonderful work at Milwaukee Children's Hospital and the fact that those children were still alive. I also have a request, and I wonder if you would speak a little bit about Louis Armstrong's choice by the president at the time to become a cultural ambassador to the world. If you could tell us more about that. And thank you so much for this good program.
Thank you, Karen.
Yes, you know, it is what a wonderful life is a tremendous performance, you know, and I'm so pleased that still people, a lot of people know that. So that's one of their main connections to Louis Armstrong still, and we're now, you know, quite a few years after his death, 1971. Yeah, The Ambassador, that started in the 50s. He did a number of tours throughout the world, went to Africa, to Eastern Europe, all through Europe, and a representative of the United States, actually. And in the 1950s, as a result of this, he became one of the most famous people in the world, actually. And so that's a powerful period of his life, actually. It definitely is a great period. And his Louis Armstrong All-Stars, it was the name of his band during that period, and there's some great music from that period.
Jerry in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Jerry.
Yes, good morning. How are you?
Fine. What's your question or comment?
Well, as it happens, I'm originally from back east, but my dad and Louis Armstrong were colleagues starting in the 30s. And I knew Louis Armstrong from the 40s to the end. And I'll say this. Several things I'd like to say about it. I'll be brief. Number one, a lot that was written about Louis Armstrong in that period of time was hype. Louis Armstrong was playing at a time of apartheid, heavy apartheid here. He was genius enough to do and say things to get him over. But the fact is that he was more of a jester for the mainstream America than a musician. He was really an innovative musician. I knew him very well as a kid. So a lot has been written about him is simply not true. It's to accommodate, again, the mainstream American. When you mentioned, for instance, that his music was not improvised, I beg to differ. And my dad played sax in his band and played sax all of his life, as did Louis. And sure, they had charts, but that was the whole thing about jazz, as it is today, progressive jazz anyway. It's all improvised. So if you make a recording today at 3 o'clock today and make it again at 4 o'clock the same day, it's totally different notes. I mean, it's improvised.
Mm-hmm.
But again, Louis Armstrong, when he was with Bing Crosby and movies, he was treated more as a court jester rather than a serious musician. And he understood that.
Thanks, Jerry. What's your response to that, that he was seen as more of a jester than a musician?
Yes, you know, that was something that he learned in the 20s. In a lot of the performing context in the 20s, humor was a huge asset, actually. So he definitely internalized that kind of performance. And that's not unusual. A lot of jazz musicians in the 20s and the 30s, even all the way into Dizzy Gillespie, someone like Dizzy Gillespie has a lot of humor in his performances. Now, Miles Davis, Charlie Parker, no, they sort of looked down on that. They wanted a more serious demeanor on stage, and they thought of that as kind of old-fashioned. As for the improvisation thing, I just want to clarify. Of course, Louis Armstrong could improvise, and of course he did improvise. But the great solos from the 20s are usually not improvised. They are solos that he played the same every time he played them, and he talks about this. So you can read about it and tell me what you think.
We were talking about his music in light of the greater social context in terms of race relations in the United States at the time. And you describe Armstrong's 1928 recording of West End Blues as proof of his mastery over both worlds, the black and white. Why so, and why is it significant? Why was it a significant development of jazz at that time?
West End Blues is one of his most famous pieces from the 20s, and it's a great piece. And were we going to play a little bit of that, maybe? Or?
Yeah. Should we listen to it first and then talk?
I'll say a little bit about
it. Okay.
The introduction is perhaps one of the most famous introductions in all of jazz. It's right up there with Duke Ellington's Mood Indigo or John Coltrane's A Love Supreme. It's a flashy, flamboyant, kind of almost heraldic fanfare, you could say. That is one way to think about it, in the military tradition of a fanfare, as a sort of proclamation of victory or political power. And it's one of a kind. There is no no statement like this really in the 20s. There are some precedents for it from Armstrong himself, but they're not quite like this. So it's a stunning sort of display of command of the instrument. And, you know, maybe I'll talk just a little bit about that for a little bit. This was recorded in June 28th, 1928, and we know that he was performing this piece at the Savoy Ballroom in Chicago. So there's a Savoy Ballroom in Chicago, the more famous one in New York. It was the owners of that owned the one in Chicago, but the one in Chicago was extremely important for Armstrong. This is a place that holds 6,000 people, that has a ballroom floor that's about 400 feet long, that has basically a shopping center in it. It has a hairdresser, it has a florist, it has all kinds of stuff. You can buy pastries. I mean, it's a massive place. It's brand new in 1927, 1928. And it's all black, by the way. I mean, basically, so when I say these places are all black, it wasn't that whites couldn't come in there. Whites could go wherever they wanted, basically. But the few whites who did go there, white musicians, would occasionally go there to see Armstrong, and they talked about how they were the only white people among this 6,000 population. We know Armstrong played this piece there. In July, Dave Payton is a writer for the Chicago Defender, and he starts talking about Armstrong. He calls him King Menelik. Now, this is a week after this piece was recorded, and he's getting called King Menelik. King Menelik was the Ethiopian king who drove the Italians out of Ethiopia as a sort of anti-colonial victory. And when he did that, he became a hero to African Americans everywhere. So this is a very powerful, powerful symbol to call Armstrong King Menelik. Dave Payton also says that Armstrong slayed the Ofay demons the other day at the Savoy Ballroom. Now, what does that mean? Slayed the Ofay demons. Ofay is African American slang for white. So this is also very pointed. And what was his weapon? His weapon would have been this piece that we're going to listen to, and especially the introduction. Why is it a weapon? Because it's really defining a territory that he alone can master. So it shows quickness, it shows precision, it shows an ability through the range of the instrument. It also shows it's totally part of the African-American vernacular. It's very bluesy. There are a lot of complicated rhythmic things going on here. It's just a stunning display. So we could listen to that, yeah.
Okay, this is the West End Blues. West End Blues by Louis Armstrong. So that is quite the fanfare at the start there.
Yeah. And I don't know, could we go a little further with that to the vocal section?
I don't know. Do we have vocals on this?
Yes.
I meant on our cut. I'm looking at my producer. It doesn't look like we do, so.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Okay.
What are we missing by not hearing that part?
Well, the vocals are done with a microphone, and we know that they had a microphone in the Savoy Ballroom. And we know that he basically stepped away from the microphone to play his trumpet and then stepped back to the microphone to sing. What this shows is his new microphone style with his voice, actually. And that's going to be very important. The microphone is going to have a big impact on the way he sings for the next few years. And it's a more subtle kind of style. Can you imagine filling up a huge ballroom like this without a microphone? And that's basically what he was doing before this. So that's going to lead to a certain kind of singing. I mean, it's going to have to be very forceful, right? You think about somebody like Bessie Smith, who has this big voice and can fill up a big hall. I mean, that's a certain kind of style of singing that's not going to be about nuance. And then you think about somebody like Billie Holiday, who's hers is a microphone-based style of singing. So Armstrong is right there at the transition, and he goes along with the transition. And so the piece we heard, Lazy River, before, that shows his microphone style of singing pretty well, actually.
I'm sorry, did you have more?
Well, and that's what's hugely influenced on Billie Holiday, actually. His style of singing.
So what happens when jazz historians and fans alike attempt to downplay the race issue when they think about, Louis Armstrong's life in particular?
Well, you know, there's an idea that jazz was at the forefront of integration, and in some ways it was, that white musicians respected black musicians, and they certainly did. They respected Louis Armstrong. That's what he's experiencing in that way in Chicago in the 20s is tremendous, and that means a lot to him. The kind of thing we were talking about with Guy Lombardo, absolutely very important. But this was not an integrated environment. There were limits on friendships, and yes, while they respected and wanted to be friends with Louis Armstrong, I'm not sure how far that extended into the black community of black musicians, and a lot of black musicians talk about that. So there is a huge imbalance in the racial structures of power, as everybody knows, and so black musicians cannot participate in the same way that white musicians can. They can't play at the same places and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have integrated bands and so forth. So there are a lot of racial dynamics going on here.
Let's take one last call from Fred in Spooner. Hi, Fred.
Good morning. I just have a very personal kind of remembrance. My wife and I were at the University of Wisconsin in, I think it was 49, and we heard Louis Armstrong play at our fraternity dance at the Lorraine Hotel. It was three fraternities sponsored. And it was a night that just was a memorable. We, of course, were fans of Louis Armstrong during the 40s as we listened to his music. And to be able to dance with him and hear him right up close and to hear his singer, Thelma Middleton, was a great privilege. So one of the highlights of our life.
Thanks for sharing that, Fred. Thomas Brothers, as we wrap up here, what have we yet to really discover or understand about Louis Armstrong's life and work?
Well, you know, as I said at the beginning, the reason I'm so drawn to this, to the, his these books, why I've done these books, they take a long time to do them, is because the music is so compelling, and because the history is so fascinating. So, you know, I relate to it on both of those levels, and I think a lot of your listeners can too. You will never be disappointed if you listen to the material from the late 20s and the early 30s. It is tremendous music. You can listen to it again and again. And it's like Bach or Beethoven in that regard. I mean, I listen to those composers. I've listened to them all my life, and I never get tired of certain pieces by the great composers. And it's like that. These pieces really stand up, and they're worth getting to know really well. You know, the other thing is how rich this period is in history and how important it is for African Americans, especially with the Great Migration and sort of a transformation of their culture and society, and how Armstrong is the leading figure in a lot of ways in what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, Thomas, thank you so much for joining us today. This was a fascinating hour, and we didn't even really put a dent in all that you wrote about in your book.
Well, I really appreciate you having me, Cynthia.
Thomas Brothers is the author of a new book called Louis Armstrong, Master of Modernism. He's also a music professor at Duke University. Thanks to Christy Taylor for producing and on-air direction this hour, and Bill Martins for on-air production. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.